Hi everyone, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is Dawn O'Porter. Dawn is a really multi-talented lady. She is a writer, a presenter, a producer, a mother, a fellow podcaster, lives in LA, is married to the actor Chris O'Dowd, who happens to be playing the lead in my husband's show, Get Shorty, on Epix. Really good. Don't miss it. I'm also going to be in season two. Sorry, secret aside and push there for the show. Anyway, so Dawn and I met through her husband and I just fell for her immediately. She is wonderful and writes fluently and funnily about modern womanhood. Her latest novel, The Cows, I devoured and laughed out loud. It's such a delightful, fun read and is about four women who are all juggling with the demands of being women in today's age, living with digital media and a public life and a private life and how to combine them and whether to have children. So lots to talk about, and we talked hard and fast about her books and what it is to be a mum and a working mum. So I loved talking to Dawn. It was a blast. Check out her podcast, which is called Get It On, which is a great podcast about clothes and the way your clothes define you. So not dissimilar to this one, but about clothes that you wear and what they say about you. You can get that on iTunes as well. All right. I hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you so much for being my guest.
You're so welcome.
This is so fun. I'm going to do that. Hi, Dawn O'Porter.
Hello, gorgeous.
Do you know, it is one of my favourite things about you is that you took the O.
I did.
That is literally, I knew that about you before I knew, oh, come on.
So tattooed on my hand, my fourth wedding anniversary present to Chris.
Was that. So just to clarify for the listeners, Dawn's unmarried name was Dawn Porter.
Which is so small. It's such a small little name now.
Is it? It's so funny. And then when you married your husband, Chris O'Dowd, you took the O, which is just, it's like if people don't know you, it's the only thing they need to know about you to know who you are.
And the crucial apostrophe as well.
Oh, of course.
So, it was a funny thing. When we were getting married, I knew I wasn't going to be Dawn O'Dowd.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to be Mrs. Anything else. But I did, you know, I really loved Chris. I was like, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with this guy. I was like, I do want to mark it in some kind of way. And I thought, how amazing that we've just got this thing. I don't have a middle name, so I didn't want some really big long name like Dawn O'Dowd Porter or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take
I don't have a middle name either. And it was so funny because it just didn't occur to me. I mean, maybe with Davey and I had a discussion, but the idea of becoming Sonia Holmes was just sort of hilarious to me. Like, hilarious and utterly improbable. And also my dad didn't have sons, so I felt quite strongly so that Walga felt sort of important to continue, you know, even though it ends with me basically.
Yeah.
But there was no way to do a Holmes Walga.
No.
Just too long, too
and
hybrid-y.
I think it's really fair enough when people don't have any more of an association with their name other than it being their name.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you've worked in an industry where you've earned your name, you've seen it in print, you've done, you know, you've been on TV or you've all sorts, not just the entertainment industry, but you really feel like you've earned your name. Sorry about my wobbly table. Then I think it's quite hard to give it up.
I agree.
And I just kind of feel like you just make your own rules, don't you? Just do your own thing. And actually, to bring it into books, when we got married, I had a book coming out shortly after our wedding.
Which one?
Paper Airplanes. And so it was a really crucial time for me to decide what my name was going to be for the rest of my writing career, because that book really defined a moment where I started to write fiction and, you know, everything changed. And so I asked them to mock up two copies of the cover. One with Dawn Porter and one with Dawn O'Porter.
Really?
And I just thought the Dawn O'Porter looked better. And that
was such a decider.
Yeah, and once I'd said, right, that's going on the book, then that was my name.
Right.
And then there's this moment where you're like, do I have a professional name or do I have... and I just wanted one name.
Yes,
like, so I
totally.
Can't be bothered with that.
No, I agree.
So I changed it by Deepal and now it's on my passport. It's completely official. And our kids are actually O'Porter as well.
Are they as well?
Yeah.
So great.
I love it too.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love that. And so then you got the tattoo of the O.
Our fourth wedding anniversary, we were in Hawaii and in this really cute hotel we're staying at, there was a little tattoo parlor opposite. And it's a bit of a tradition because for our wedding, for my wedding present to Chris, I got him a tattoo on my bottom of the dog, the cat, and the word Munchies, which was our nickname for each other. So for our fourth wedding anniversary, I was like, right, I'll go and get the O for him.
Did he know that was happening?
I think so. Yes, he did. And then he also wanted to get a tattoo for me. And he couldn't decide what to do, so he just got a heart on his ribcage, which is really, really sweet, but he nearly died. When I left, I went...
Isn't that the most painful place to do it?
Poor guy. Honestly, he was trying to be really romantic, and I swear, I think it's damaged him for life, psychologically. We had our one-year-old with us, so I took our one-year-old out while Chris got it, and when I went back, he was white, and apparently he had to like lie in a different position. He thought he was going to faint, like the worst experience of his life. But now
was that his first tattoo? And his last.
I think it probably will be. Oh, sweet man.
Bless his heart. Such a lovely thing. I haven't got any tattoos, nor has Davey. It wouldn't have occurred to me either. It was such a lovely thing to do.
You really have to love them.
You really do.
The tradition kind of started for me when I was 18 and I had 143 put on my bottom for this guy that I was going out with.
Has your bottom got any room left on it? Yeah,
well, and that's what the one for Chris replaced. It went over it because he'd had to see this tattoo that was for another guy. And 143 meant I love you. It was this code that this guy and I had in that kind of way. When you're 18, you think you'll be with this person
forever.
And so, for our wedding present, I got it covered up.
With a dog and a cat.
Our dog and our cat. A friend of Chris's, he's a cartoonist, and I got him to draw the dog and the cat and then had that put on my bum.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So clever. I love this.
Genius bum tattoos.
Tell me something. What are you reading now?
Well, just before you arrived, I did a little bit of a tirade on Instagram because reading at the moment is quite frustrating. I have a 7-month-old and a 3-year-old.
Yes.
And
say no more.
Well, yeah.
Say no more.
And it really upsets me because reading is a real joy and pleasure in my life. And I'm like, wow, I don't do that one simple thing anymore. It makes you realise how little time with a job and a kid you get to actually be on your own without just sleeping. Two kids.
Yeah. And a working husband.
And so I, just about get through maybe one episode of a TV show at night and then go to bed to read and I'm asleep within 20 seconds. Mm. So I need to factor it into my working day as a writer to give myself an afternoon at least a week where I read, because without consuming stories, you can't write stories. Mm.
That's interesting. So you can consume while you write?
Yes. And as much as I, very often when I get stressed about word output, I think, I haven't got time to read. I always, without doubt, have a better writing day the day after I've read something.
Really?
Like, it just, generating words in your head in and out, it's all just part of the same circle. You just got to keep it going in and keep it coming out. And so just before you got here, I sat down in the garden because we're in Los Angeles and it's really sunny and whatever month this is. And I started to read The Sellout.
Oh, the Paul Beattie book.
Yes. So I got about 5 pages in.
Yes, I think that's as far as I've got in.
Yeah. So a lot of people say that.
Mm.
But very often with those literary books, prize-winning books, you either click with the wordiness of them or you don't.
I agree. I also think it's a tough one. I similarly got into it, I think, quite soon after it came out, which is over a year ago, I think. So Jakey was just a bit younger, probably nearer Val's age than what he is now. And it felt too inaccessible. It felt too much of a device. It felt too...
Yeah.
And yet it's been raved about. I think the other issue for me is that it's on my fucking Kindle.
Yeah.
And it's too easy for me to leave books behind on the Kindle. I tend to finish...
You don't feel it, so you just download another one and move
exactly. On. I sort of don't notice. And I'm reading your book, The Cows, on my Kindle because I wanted it immediately. And as I said, devouring it, adoring it.
Thank you, sir.
I really, really have no problem finishing or highly recommending.
It's quite pacey.
Oh, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare because it was 10:15 last night and I was like, I'll just do one more chapter. And then something really, really pivotal happened, and I'm going to avoid ruining it for people because it's got a few fantastic pivotal moments that are real cliffhangers. And I was like, you fucker, you fucker, I got to push on.
Yeah.
So then it was 11 o'clock. Anyway, I'm 76% of the way through.
Wow, thank you.
But that's where the Kindle is the joy, obviously, for the immediacy of it.
Yeah.
But I find it really too easy to sort of just walk away with impunity. And even actually, because I've stopped the Kindle lately, because I've really wanted the kids to see me reading actual books,
yes,
just so that they realize I'm not just endlessly on a screen all the time. And so that they equate, you know, so that they know they are in a family that mm-hmm. reads. We all do, but sometimes it's too easy for us to look like we're all on iPads.
Yes, that's a really good point.
So I've gone back to actual books for that reason. So I hadn't been on the Kindle for a bit. I realize I'm seeing you and I wanted to read The Cows for ages anyway. So I quickly download it. And that was where I discovered that I had maybe 6 brand new untouched books, one of which is The Sellout, which is at 5%, so suggests I'm about as far in as you are. And it just depressed me. It just made me feel I wouldn't have 6 unread novels sitting by the bed.
I know. It's an odd thing. I do love how you can read an article about, I mean, as a writer and someone who's that is selling work, mm-hmm. it's a really great thing to know that someone can read an article and download your book
immediately,
that minute, rather than have to kind of wait for their lunch hour, go and get a sandwich, and by the time they've done that, they've forgotten all about your book. So in terms of like supporting work, it's a really great thing, but it's I do move on from books really quickly on it, and you're right, you don't want to be on a screen all the time. I do tend to do this thing where if I read a book on a Kindle, I've lost my Kindle, by the way, I haven't seen it for a year, which says a great deal about the amount that I've read. I say to Chris, where is my Kindle? And one day I'm just gonna see it and it'll be like this really geriatric machine, like,
completely outdated.
Well, now we're reading hologram books in our living room. But I do. Oh, yes, that was it. So if I have a thing, because I write books, where if I read a book on the Kindle, I have to buy the book as well.
Oh,
so put it on the shelf.
Right.
Because
that's a nice habit.
We have to keep going with books. Otherwise, they really will just go.
Do you know, I was so enraged the other day. I went to, there's that brand new mall that opened, or renovated mall in Century City. I think it's Westfield.
Oh, yeah.
Westfield
it's
Centre.
Quite the spaceship, isn't
it? It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
It's sort of astonishing. I walked around with my tongue out the whole time. And the part that had me really troubled was I walked past a store and it said Amazon on the outside, and I doubled back because I couldn't believe it, and it is an actual bricks and mortar Amazon bookstore, and I just felt this wave of rage and betrayal.
Yeah.
The idea that this globalized, albeit brilliant, but you know, to begin with, a book company has put every book company out of business.
No, it's really
every
sad.
Single bookstore out of business, and has now come back with its own bookstore. Watch me never get Amazon as a sponsor right now.
Yeah.
But I just felt like it was just sort of horrifying. It was like something out of a terrible corporate horror film.
It's really sad. I mean, saying that, you know, I ordered a book from Amazon yesterday. Like, I
live on Amazon.
I know.
I do too. It's just the idea that they're going to the bricks and
really
mortar
sad.
Little bookstores don't get book soup is, you know, hanging on by a thread. There's just no bookstores anymore. And the idea that the only
really
ones
sad.
That will be left are Amazon run as well just sort of broke my heart.
I know. Even the big one, I love walking around Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And just... you kind of think, what was the one that just is gone in London now, or England? Was it one of the big ones? Just doesn't exist anymore.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember. Maybe it was in America. I can't remember. Fascinating content. You're so welcome.
No,
everyone.
Come on.
That was the moment that they'll rewind, record,
play that,
and
again.
Just like tweet it out repeatedly. For like, no, that was genius.
But don't you? It's one of the things I miss about home. Actually, is you know, I live in, my family's all in Fulham, and Fulham has, and Chelsea both have a collection of really fantastic
yeah.
independent bookstores, and it's one of my favourite things because they're so beautifully curated. You know, little John Sando and Sons or Nomad Books in Fulham, they are these, you go and that little round table with mm-hmm. recommendations from the staff is just not a recommendation I'll find anywhere else.
No, it's not, but you have to be what I've learned about being involved in this industry is that there aren't that many readers.
Hmm.
Like, really, you think it really... But not that many people buy books. And then a small fraction of those people that buy books aren't buying it because they're interested in the author or they've been sucked in by a bit of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
A small percentage of those people have come across your book because of a recommendation like that.
Right.
Or because they've gone out to buy a new book
mm-hmm.
and they've really searched and this is the one that they've discovered.
Yeah.
It just isn't how people do it anymore. It's
right.
like, you're sitting at your desk, you'll see an article will get tweeted,
mm-hmm.
you may or may not be interested and or a famous person has written a book or whatever. It's just a new way of
right.
doing it. So that kind of
curated
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, it just
yeah.
doesn't. And also, you see those bookshops now desperately trying to make money in other places, like putting
right.
on events, or suddenly there's
coffee
a cafe
shops.
In them,
yeah,
or something
exactly.
like that. And like, oh, this is really tragic.
Yeah.
And you know, we should all at least once a year go into a bookshop and buy a book.
Yes.
But it feels like it's getting harder and harder.
I know. I sort of pray in the same way that cheese shops and sort of designer butchers have all made a comeback. And,
yeah, you know, that's true.
It really gives me hope that there is a resurgence for this boutique experience.
Will. I think while we all get obsessed with this new age of technology and it's kind of sweeping us all away in this kind of fascinating, wow, what's next type feeling, human beings will always crave great stories. Mm. And I think there will be no technology that is as satisfying as turning the pages of a book.
I agree.
And so we'll go through all this. Of course, they'll make some cool, trendy, hipster, vintage comeback at some point, and then we will all be reading books again.
It will be. It'll be like records. Yeah. It'll be like the fun of having a record player and stuff.
But that's why. So I do. I always buy the book if I've bought it on Kindle or listen to the audiobook.
Oh, yeah. Who do you like? Do you like readers in particular?
Not really.
Do you care if it's the author, for instance?
It's always quite fun when it is.
Did you narrate the cows?
I did. I did the character of Tara, which was terrifying.
I bet.
And then I cast the other two.
Did you choose to do Tara as opposed to Cam or Stella?
Well, they wanted me to do the whole thing, but it's three different characters' perspectives, and I just thought that was ridiculous. So I chose Tara and then forgot that there was like four lines of Russian accent. And suddenly I'm in the booth and I'm like, guys, I think I need a break. Need to just work this out. Who knows? And I kind of Googled Russian tutorials on YouTube.
Great.
And then did a terrible attempt at it.
Great.
I mean, it was fun to do. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a really good audiobook is just such a treat, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fabulous.
I agree.
I've said this before on the podcast, but I'm a real fan of self-help books on audio.
Oh, nice.
For some reason, I find them sort of unendurable by the bed, really. And I can't help feeling like this is not a waste of my time, but I'd rather be reading fiction. I would much rather be what precious time there is for reading. But somehow listening to self-help in the car, I find like it goes in properly. It sort of settles and I'm more receptive to it, particularly if it is the author reading it. Yeah, so those are my ones. Esther Perel is a favourite of mine. Do you know her? She's someone I'm dying to get on the podcast. Esther, if you're listening, watch out. She's this incredible Belgian psychotherapist who's done this. She wrote an amazing book called Mating in Captivity, which is about marriage. And she wrote a book called The State of Affairs that just came out this year. She spent 7 years researching infidelity, all different sides of it, the perpetrator, the victim, the mistress, or, you know, third party. And then she did this amazing series of podcasts where they're live therapy sessions with married couples, anonymous, so you never know who they are. But each one is talking about a different problem, be it infertility or infidelity or
that's really good.
Parenting. They're called Where Shall We Begin? And you can get them on iTunes or Audible.
I'm all over that.
And it's absolutely wonderful. Yeah. So she's someone I'm sort of mesmerized by. So she's not so much self-help as sort of therapized and fascinating. Anyway, enough of this. Tell me, which is the first? I loved your books, by the way. They were really fun. Yeah, I knew them all, and it was just fun because we haven't had any of them. And I wonder which one you would like to start with.
What should I start with?
Where to begin?
Let's start with A Room of One's Own.
Mm. Virginia Woolf, yes. 1929.
Yes, I haven't read it in a long time, but certain elements of that book.
When did you read it?
I would have read it around the time that I met Chris, so probably around 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And no, actually, it was probably around a year and a half later when I was getting really back into writing again, around the time that I got the paper airplanes deal, because I'd had a bit of a shitty time career-wise for a few years before that, and TV work had dried up, and I was out here, and it was just all rubbish. And then I got this call from an editor saying that she read some columns I'd written, would I consider writing fiction? I was like, what? And that's how Paper Airplanes happened. I got started to really read about other women's experiences of writing, and I kind of got led towards Virginia Woolf and her line, a woman needs money and a room of her own to write fiction, resonated with me so much because I'd been skint for pretty much 5 years.
Hmm.
Like, right, a little bit less than that, but really, really, really skinned.
Since moving to LA.
I moved to LA to do a documentary. And I did a series and it was all great. And then the series was going to get taken again, do a second series. And then after a year of waiting, they just decided not to. Meanwhile, I'd spent all my money, was on the other side of the world. My career had kind of dwindled in the UK. And
isn't it fun when that happens? Yeah. I've had the identical,
yeah,
by the way.
It was really
such a good
fun.
Time. Yeah.
And then I met Chris just at the time that he was doing Bridesmaids and literally taking over the planet. And I was like, oh, right, so you're doing all right then, are you? Anyway, it was just a bit of a miserable few years, which now just seems so silly, but it wasn't great at the time.
Yeah.
And so all I ever really wanted to do was write. So I kind of done this TV thing, and that was all well and good, and offered me lots of opportunities, but I really just kind of longed to write the whole time. So I got this opportunity to write Paper Airplanes, and I just needed motivational quotes, and I needed to I needed to kind of read things by other people who had struggled to get words down, having, you know, been through whatever they've been through, whatever, all this stuff. So I was just scouring for you can do it type stories.
Solidarity, yeah.
And this was the book, A Woman Needs Money and Have a Room of Her Own to Write Fiction, made me feel like I had a little goal. Mm. I need to get myself financially independent and secure, because I'd met Chris and he was he'd kind of helped me out. He moved in and paid the rent and all that. And I was like, that was great. But I also, it didn't make me feel amazing. Mm-hmm. I wanted the stress. I didn't feel like I needed to be rich at all. I just wanted to be able to be independent.
Yeah.
And I wanted a space to write in. And I think your space to write in is crucial. And all these years later, I still don't know if I've nailed it. We're sitting outside my house now in our office, which is outside. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice, but it really is Chris's office, but he's on production at the moment, so I'm using it. Mm-hmm. I write in a cafe across the road, mm-hmm. and I write in a little kind of space for writers, not very far away. And it's all working fine, mm-hmm. but I still have this goal in life of having a room of my own.
I'm right there with
you.
Yeah,
that line resonates with me every day. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want. And I love that book so much because she put that in my head. She gave me my goal. And people say to me sometimes, what's your end goal? And I went, and I think really the only thing I want, apart from, you know, my healthy family and my love, and I mean, uh-huh. work-wise, all I'm working for to be able to achieve in my career is a studio-type situation full of vintage dresses with a desk in the middle that is my own room.
Mm. Wonderful. What a great vision.
That's just it.
Yeah.
And it's like when you realise that's all you want.
Books and dresses. Right there with you, Lynn.
And that's weirdly, I don't know if many people have taken that away from a Virginia Woolf book, but that's really, it gave me my goal, it gave me my dream, it made me realise what I needed. Mm-hmm. And so I just love the book for that reason.
I'm so struck that you came to that even without having had kids, because I think it's something that women arrive at often when they've had the invasion and the sort of, you know, it's not just a physical invasion, it's an invasion of one's mental space too when you have children, and suddenly realising your brain is so occupied keeping these little things alive and healthy and fed, and is he going
it's,
to it's
a
violin
it's the most
practice
full-time job you'll ever do.
Yeah.
And after I had art, my deadline for the cows was just after I had art.
Whoa.
Which was horrendous and so stressful, and the fact that that book ended up being readable and did well blows my mind, because I've never been so stressed in my life.
Right.
I also had a business at the time, which I've now let go, because that level of stress just was not worth it.
Right.
But
what was the business? Was that vintage clothes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was great, but I was running it from the other side of the world, and it was taking me away from the two things I love more than anything else in the world, my kid and my books.
Right.
Like, my husband, he obviously comes
he's fixing
that
it. That's
bracket.
A given. Let's make that the background to it all. Yeah.
Just make
as
sure
an aside.
It somewhere. So the business had to go. I think you've got to, when you have kids, you have to not be a martyr. And if you have a real ambition and a real passion like I do for writing, then you have to clear the way.
Yeah.
As also what Virginia Woolf was saying is, you know, women were imposed with such a role in society, so downtrodden. They were given, you know, an idea would come into their head and then they'd find themselves having to scrub toilets. And so before they know it, they'd never get the chance to write that idea down.
Mm.
And actually that clarity of knowing that you've got time to think, to honour yourself with giving yourself that space in your head and that physical space of having a room is how you create stuff. So I got rid of the business because it was just like a constant fog.
Yeah.
And then everything changed. And now since I've had Valentine, what's amazing about that, which I can't quite believe, I went back to work when Val was 6 months. So it's only been a month since I've rather pathetically been going back to work.
Come on.
My head is so clear. I feel so on top of it this time. I really feel, I don't know what's different. Maybe it's because I got the practice of having art, but I feel so in control of my headspace this time. I can compartmentalize. I can be like, right, I have childcare from 9 to 5, so I work from 9 to 5. I'm just much more organized. But
that makes such sense. I think that second kid thing is huge. Yeah. I think when it first happens to you, you just don't know what's happened to your body, to your emotions, to how long you should, in inverted commas, breastfeed or not.
Yeah.
Or the guilt of leaving them with the nanny or whatever. And by the second kid, you're like, this kid is absolutely fucking fine.
Yeah. You do, you're much
calmer. Boobs will come and go,
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly.
And
I did have
works,
that with art. I was like, I've got to get this book in. So I got childcare when he was about 5 months. I didn't want it. I wasn't ready. So yeah, there was all of that. This time with Val, I was like, right, 6 months, get her in.
Done.
I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Totally.
Which is really nice. But yeah, I feel like you just kind of get a grip a bit more. So yeah, Virginia Woolf, Around the World Zone, it spoke to me and still speaks to me.
I loved when I was rereading about it, it's been years since I've read it too. I think I read it at Oxford because I did a paper on Virginia Woolf, who I love. I remembered as I was reading around it, this lovely thing she talks about where she talks about if Shakespeare had a sister.
Yes.
His sister would never have written a word.
The parallel life.
Yeah. And I pulled this quote out because I loved it. I told you in the course of this paper that Shakespeare had a sister, but do not look for her in Sir Sidney Lee's Life of the Poet. She died young. Alas, she never wrote a word. She lies buried where the omnibuses now stop, opposite the Elephant and Castle. Now, my belief is that this poet who never wrote a word and was buried at the crossroads still lives. She lives in you and in me and in many other women who are not here tonight, for they are washing up the dishes and putting the children to bed. But she lives, for great poets do not die. They are continuing presences. They need only the opportunity to walk among us in the flesh. I just love that. I love the idea of us being Shakespeare's sister and then being in those of us that write and continue to, you know, engage with books, whether you're writing them or not. But
exactly.
If you're still involved in a life of story, then you do keep that alive. And it's, you know, as women, it's on us to keep that going.
I think. Really is. I mean, there are still, you know, the idea that there were all those brilliant female minds with all those great ideas who were just repressed and never got the chance to tell their stories is so depressing.
Yeah.
Just makes you want to shout, doesn't it?
I know.
And just be like, right, if you've got an opportunity to tell your story, you should always tell it.
Yeah.
And I think there is also an element of women aren't encouraged in the same, I think it's obviously it's the best time ever to be female,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, you can imagine back in the 60s even where women wouldn't have been encouraged to be bold and tell their stories,
mm-hmm.
feel confident creatively. They really had mm-hmm. to fight through something to get their story told.
Sure.
But men have just always been encouraged and given the space and the time.
Right. But on the other hand,
she said this 100 years ago and you're still thinking,
1929. Yeah. But on the other hand, without being too Pollyanna-ish about it, I think the fact that women have been encouraged to be so emotionally expressive where men have not
mm-hmm.
means that now that our time is coming to be to speak out, and that hopefully there's going to be this catching up between our intellectual, and not that our intellectual abilities have ever been in question, but that their ability to be expressed in the world is going to be in tandem with an emotional maturity that I don't think men have necessarily been in access.
Well, wouldn't that be
to?
Wonderful? I think the future of women in the creative industry is really exciting.
Tell me, have you always been, you may resent the word, but a feminist?
I think so. Mm. But then saying that, I think in my, the kind of person that I am, I probably always have been. But, you know, back in Guernsey in the 90s, I don't know if I even heard the word.
Yeah, no, sure.
And I think,
me too.
Yeah, and I think there would have been a part of me that would just, I think then I would have moved to London and heard about feminism and thought it was just a bunch of big fat lesbians who drink herbal tea.
Right.
Because I would have had a very closed-minded, not closed-minded at all, actually, just uneducated view on activism, having been brought up in a very middle-class white place on a tiny island where it was just very sheltered.
Right.
So I think I had some real catching up to do, and as soon as I learned what feminism really was, I was just right there on it.
Mm. What do you think brought you to it? Or was there a book that did? Was any of these?
I mean,
because they're all, it's interesting, yours are all, I don't know if Terry Newman is a man or a woman. I'm assuming that's a man. But all four of your five authors are women.
Yeah, and also quite strong characters.
And totally,
so,
independent, headstrong women, all of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just think that fundamentally, I lost my mum when I was very young. My auntie raised me, but there was very much kind of
Was your mum, do you remember your mum being someone who was feisty? Or?
No.
No.
And I often think, you know, I was at the Women's March last month and I was like, I don't know if she would have been here.
Interesting.
I don't know if she was that person. She was very cool, hilarious, loads of fun and, you know, and adventurous and wild. But I don't know. No one's really spoken to me like she was a feminist.
Right.
So I don't know that. But my auntie... is my auntie a feminist? She always had her own business. You know, she was that woman. She's her own person. Mm-hmm. I think she's, rather than maybe being a feminist in the terms of being an activist, I think she just lives out, you know, a strong female existence.
Right.
So I think that would be my influence.
Yeah.
And I think when you don't have a mom, like my auntie was, you know, brought me up, but she wasn't a mom.
Right.
I was very much fending for myself, which makes you quite solid or not maybe, but it did, made me quite strong. And so I was quite... just strident in my own beliefs of what I was capable of.
Right.
And so I don't know. And I think I learned about feminism and learned that I was one probably quite late on.
Right.
And realised, yeah, of course I am. That fits everything that I believe and want to believe and how I want women to be and what I think is right.
Right. So interesting. It's so exciting that you have boys.
Oh, God, I'm so glad I have boys.
It's so wonderful. Well, I always think that. I always think that when really strong, articulate women that I know have sons, but who also have, you know, full hearts as you do, I feel like it's so great because we need men in the world with mothers like this.
Well, this is how I feel. I feel like
it's your responsibility to raise a good man.
I'm gonna make the world a safe place for women.
Yeah.
Safer place for women. I'll take that whole job on myself as a mother of two boys. But I didn't know if Valentine was a boy or a girl, and when he came out, I knew he was a boy just in my heart.
Uh-huh.
And when he came out, I was like, yes.
Yes.
Because I know this is what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
I was petrified of having a girl.
Right.
Having been a teenage girl, I didn't want to have to deal with that. It was horrendous.
And you've got a sister too.
And we were both horrendous.
Great.
So in all the fun, naughty ways. So I just wanted boys. I just want to raise great guys. Mm. And, you know, poor Art's three and I'm like, I'm just make him talk about feelings. I'm just like, so I need these always guy. He's like, I asked him this morning, I said, Artie, I need to get you some more shoes. What colour do you want? He said pink. And I was like, my work here is done.
Goodbye,
you know, he's very,
so good.
But you know, then he's also obsessed with cars and trucks and all this kind of really standard boy stuff, which I think is wonderful, but they will grow up to have feelings, to see that women, you know, I mean, the thing is that, you know, our roles in our house are very defined, and without us really meaning it to be, Chris is a really hands-on dad. Mm. Like when he's not on production, we do alternate mornings. He puts Art to bed most nights, fun with the baby. Mm-hmm. Like he does so much. But in terms of like household stuff, I do all the cooking and Chris does all the DIY.
Yes,
so
us too.
Yeah, so I'm like, there's stuff like that, but I love that because I love that. Those aren't roles in our family that we're pissed off about.
Right.
Like we do, I'm passionate
to
about
your strengths,
cooking.
Right.
And I love that. I love that being a female role. I really do. Like, I love being the mother in the kitchen and taking care of and licking my finger and wiping their mouths and doing all that stuff. I love it. I don't want to be anything else. I don't want to be the one doing those things that people sometimes think is a feminist issue of, you know, changing tires and putting up shelves. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Hate it. No interest.
Yeah.
I literally can barely use the TV remote control.
I'm the same.
Chris does all of this. So our boys will see quite defined roles in that way. But, you know, like you do with Jakey and your little gorgeous girl. They like, they're in the kitchen, but they're not, they're doing cooking.
It's
just not about the fact that she's doing
it. No, it's not gendered.
It's not gendered,
yeah.
But, you know, I love it. I love the fact that I'm a mother and a woman and female and soft and emotional and that Chris is, you know, tough and doing those things. That, I think, is perfect.
I agree. I totally agree.
But at the same time, I work. I'm, you know, I'm going to teach them how to treat women.
Yeah.
I can't wait to have the first condoms talk with them.
Sending Jakey over to you for that one.
I can't wait. I've just got this fantasy where I just go into their room, they're both together, and I give them both a condom. They'll probably be around. I'd say Val's probably going to be, you know, I've got to get them early before they're doing it when I don't know about them. So maybe Val's going to be 12 and Art will be 14. And I'm going to go and like, look, dudes, here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you're going to have sex with girls, that's okay. I can't stop you being a fucking dickhead if you don't wear one of these.
Yep.
I'm going to show them pictures of sexual diseases.
Oh, so good.
And I'm going to explain to them how if a woman says no, then no. If she hasn't said yes, and you should always ask, and you should always wash your hands and your dick before you have sex. And then I'm just going to leave. And they will be so horrified and never come out of their room and never have sex with anyone because I ruined their lives.
So good. I'm really loving the detail of showing the photos of STDs.
Yeah,
if this, nothing is going to hammer it home.
This is the boil that you will get on the end of your penis if you don't wear this condom
That's
that your mother gave you.
Fucking great. Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's talk about your next book, On the Throes of Heels of That. I have Jane Eyre down next. Do
okay.
you want to do that?
Another classic that I didn't read it till quite late. Again, probably around 8 years ago. And I was just going through the whole thing going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I just relate to so many of this. Not relate. I don't know if it's relate, but just the character resonated with me. She felt so modern despite the fact that she was so old-fashioned.
1847 it came out, yeah.
And I think one thing I love about Jane Eyre, and you hear this a lot, about unlikable characters in fiction, but you know when we're so saturated with beauty and and image, and she just, you know, one of the things about Jane Eyre is that she's not beautiful, and it's just a testament to the power of beautiful writing where you fall in love with this woman, and I have such fantasies about Charlotte Bronte. And some I was googling this actually to see if it was true, and I can't find any evidence of it, but I'm sure I heard it on something about the Brontes that she just disappeared up to an attic for 2 weeks and wrote Jane Eyre.
In two weeks?
Well, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I think it was a very different writing process back then.
Yeah.
No distractions to the internet, no Twitter, no Instagram. The idea that you just kind of waddle up to your attic room with a candle and come up with a story like that, whether it took her 4 months or 2 weeks, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I just love the whole romance of the Bronte sisters. But Jane Eyre is the one that spoke to me the most.
Did you read it because you went, oh, I haven't read Jane Eyre and I should? Or did someone give it to you? No,
yeah, I read it because I thought I should read more classics because I was, despite the only subject I enjoyed at school being English literature and drama, I still was rubbish at reading. And I would, you know, with any book over 150 pages, I would just get the cliff notes. So I just felt like I needed to kind of do one, and I ended up reading Jane Eyre about 4 times in a row.
Did you really?
And listened to a really nice audiobook of it, but I can't remember who did that, but there's obviously thousands of them. I love the love story.
Yeah.
I just love the love story. That lion reader, I married him, made me want to write 1,000 books.
Didn't it? It's wonderful, isn't it? It's so funny, because we'll just go back to what you were saying about the speed that she wrote it in. I was reading this article that was saying that what a magical year 1847 was for English literature, because her sister came out with Wuthering Heights 4 months earlier. Wuthering Heights came out, and then 4 months later, or maybe 5 months later, Jane Eyre came out. Yeah, and then what was another one that came out? Maybe 6 months after that, Anyway, just this extraordinary sort of productive. I think Middlemarch came out, which is George Eliot, obviously, but I think that came out that year too. And it was just this extraordinary year for female fiction, even though they obviously published under male pseudonyms. But I agree, there's something about the myth just of those sisters alone that is so
just fascinating. I'd love to go to their house. I've never done that. Mariella Fostrop did a really nice radio documentary about the Bronte sisters.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know, they just...
Well, there's the horrific dad who is the parson, I think. He was a parson and I think really vindictive and oppressive. So much of what they're doing and writing, it comes out of, you know, a reaction to that.
Yeah.
Which is also interesting in its miniature way of like, oh, what happens to women when responding to oppressive patriarchy. You know.
The way that women, you know, creative women will turn an experience like that into a beautiful story or use it in ways to, you know, write men. I find that amazing. Virginia Woolf talks about the Brontes a lot as well and their process. I think it was Goose, the second book of Paper Airplanes. We were in Dunleary in Ireland because Chris was filming Moonboy, and I went off the internet, well, off Twitter for 5 weeks and just sat in this beautiful house by the sea and just wrote this book. And I just kept thinking, this is the closest I'll get to ever how it felt like being a Bronte sister. And they found that when you take away the distraction of the world and just you're able to kind of sit in your...
withdrawal, yeah.
Yeah, and you do, you pull all the experiences from your own life, and whether they make it into the book or not doesn't matter. You're there all the time. So to have a father like that, to have sisters like that, to be in a time like that, to be, you know, oppressed in that way, to write these amazing things but not even be able to use your real name because you know it won't sell, it's just all must give you so much inspiration. Mm. Even if it feels oppressive.
Mm. Have you read Wide Sargasso Sea?
No.
Do you know about it?
No.
So this woman, Jean Rhys, wrote this amazing book called Wide Sargasso Sea, and it is written from the point of view of Mrs. Rochester.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So it's there's so little known about Mrs. Rochester. To those of you that haven't read Jane Eyre, Jane Eyre falls in love with a sort of Byronic, beautiful, dark man, brooding man called Mr. Rochester. And it turns out Mr. Rochester has a wife who's insane in the attic of the enormous house. I can't remember what the house is called, something very well known. Anyway, and Mrs. Rochester goes mad and sets fire to the house. Jane Eyre is gone and comes back to discover the house is a cindered ruin. And Mrs. Rochester has been under the care of a woman called Grace Poole, who is someone that my mum was obsessed with when she was young. And she and her friends used to playing Mrs. Rochester and being, they would be more excited about being Grace Poole, who was the nutty drunk caretaker who was supposed to be in charge of Mrs. Rochester, but who was too drunk, and hence Mrs. Rochester burnt the house down. Anyway, there are very few facts about Mrs. Rochester in the story of Jane Eyre. But Jean Rhys took what little there was, which is that she was raised in the West Indies, and wrote this book that is so beautiful. It is so not a spin-off. You could read it without having ever read Jane Eyre.
Okay, well, I will.
And it's gorgeous, and it's lyrical and poetic, and she's not trying to do Jane Eyre. She's not trying to do the Brontes. Jean Rhys is a contemporary writer. It's just amazing, and it's about this woman coming from the West Indies and coming to the cold, cold, dark moors and marrying Rochester and it not turning out well and then being relegated to the attic. So it's just this wonderful...
And she's in the attic in the book?
Yeah, it's this wonderful other point of view, and then you get glimpses of Jane Eyre through it.
Amazing.
Yeah, so I really recommend that. I thought of it when I was... I've read Sargasso Sea years ago, and I thought of it as I was researching this and thinking, I wonder if you knew it.
No, I will. I'll look that up for sure.
So which comes next for you? I have Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Legendary Authors and the Clothes They Wore, or We Need to Talk About Kevin.
So let's do We Need to Talk About Kevin, because that's a short, sharp burst of high emotion.
Great, go for it. Okay. Holy moly.
I read it. Oddly, used to live two doors down from Lionel Shriver.
Really?
In London. She doesn't like it when I say where we lived on the wireless, which is fair enough. She's such a dude. And I desperately wanted to meet her. I'd read We Need to Talk About Kevin, and I kind of... No, I hadn't read it, and I knew she lived two doors down, but I'd read loads of interviews that she'd done. She fascinated me, so I read We Need to Talk About Kevin, knowing that the author of it lived two doors down. And this book, out of all the books in the world, I don't know if I would describe it as my favourite book, the best book, but, well, actually, that depends how you define a best book.
Sure.
A book to put you through the experience that I had when I read We Need to Talk About Kevin surely makes it actually a best book, because I was so gripped, so consumed, so lost in this world, so terrified, so shocked at the revelations, so shocked at the twists, so obsessed with her, the character, and me trying to work out who I really thought she was. Mm. I went on such a journey. When I finished it, I could only go out for dinner with people who I knew had read the book, because it's all I could talk about. Mm. And if I went out for dinner with somebody or saw somebody who hadn't read the book, then I told them the entire book, because then I still need to talk about it. All the while knowing that Lionel Shriver's two doors down. I'm like, how the fuck am I going to meet this woman? I can't bear it. I can't bear it. I can't bear it. I was just like... Oh, I just didn't know how to cope. It was such an intense experience for me. Yeah. I just loved it because it gave me true fear. And I had a nephew, my first nephew, little Bilsey, who I love so much, and couldn't look him in the eye.
Really? How old was he?
A baby.
Right.
Couldn't look him in the eye. I'd hold him and I'd be like, oh, he's obviously going to kill us. He's going to kill all of us.
Murderer.
He is going to be a murderer. Oh, it really got me. And then I go on to have two boys and have to just forget that I ever read this book.
Yeah, you did.
I thought the film was great, but it's not a patch on the book.
No, not
and
at all.
And I think they did a great job with it. And but the tiny details in the book that they had to miss out the film in the film had just made the book for me. I love the fact that it was written in letters. I thought that was really clever. And I've read other books that have written in letters before and it's been really boring.
I find them really hard work.
And actually, like, you know...
But my heart sinks. I tend to flick ahead and go, God, is the whole thing going to be
same.
Lessons?
And even though when I was writing The Cows, there's quite a few emails in it. And even writing emails, I was like, there's something that shifts the attention of the reader or just isn't interesting when the text changed something. So I was really aware of that. And I, around the time that, you know, email became so big, I remember lots of books coming out where the whole book was written in emails. Mm. Couldn't get past the first few pages. Mm. Really just don't like it as a style at all. But this written in letters, I absolutely loved. And so this book just drove me crazy for so long. And then Chris and I went on honeymoon and, a week into our honeymoon, my Siamese cat, who you just saw, it went missing.
Ooh.
And it was just absolutely devastating for me. It really, really ruined the first week of our honeymoon. I was just trying so hard to keep a brave face on for Chris, and I know he was trying to, but we were just absolutely devastated. And anyway, after a week, we got to St. Lucia, and which was our kind of third destination. We had a really lovely honeymoon. We'd organised the most extravagant part of our whole thing was to get a speedboat from the top of St. Lucia to the bottom of St. Lucia. And so we're sitting on this boat and there's champagne and we're just like, and I'm just pretending to be happy going, this should be the best experience of my life because what we're doing right now is ridiculous. Anyway, I just got a text message from my next door neighbour holding the cat.
No.
And the cat had turned up on Lionel Shriver's doorstep.
No.
So then, not only has my cat come home, so I now good. Have an excuse to go around and say thank you for bringing my cat home. So it was awesome. So anyway, Lionel's now not a friend as such, but we email sometimes. She came to my last book launch and she's now just an awesome person who I'm so happy I know. And what I love about her is that she's not a horrible, dark, mean person at all. She doesn't have kids, she didn't want kids or whatever. I don't actually know the reasons why. But she's just a really cool lady. But she's got this thing about this toughness. And yes, of course, it was her that wrote that book. And I love that. Mm. I love that I believe that there's a part of her that doesn't understand why you'd have children and so could create this story about kids becoming murderers. Mm-hmm. And I love that about her, that she just went for it. Because a lot of people were like, you don't have kids, how can you write that? And that's exactly why she can write that character, because she can make a child that she doesn't have into whatever she wants it to be.
Right.
And it was quite brave writing about a horrible subject that is very, very real. And
I agree. I thought also it was incredibly brave, not just to make Kevin who he was, but to make the mother so completely ambivalent, androgynous, unsympathetic.
Yeah.
I mean, she breaks Kevin's arm, as I remember.
Yeah,
at one
point.
I thought that was brave. I think anytime you create an unsympathetic narrator who is not unsympathetic, it's too strong, but a narrator that you have ambivalence about, and that particularly when you've got letters involved, so you've got no other way to see around, you're trying to peer around the corners, but
so
you've
clever.
Only got her point of view to go on. So you're stuck with her, whether you like her or not. Mm. And then you find yourself getting used to her and liking her for her honesty and liking her for her ambivalence about motherhood and maternity and all of that. I thought that, as much as the subject matter, I thought the choice of narrator and heroine was really, really brave.
Me too.
That was...
Oh, God, I'm going to read it again at some point. I don't read many dark books because I scare easily. I get really freaked out.
Me too.
But that one, I mean, that one made me want to read more. I seem to remember reading something a bit, like, thrillerish afterwards and just being like, nah.
No, you haven't got it.
It's
interesting. I read an article in The Guardian that she wrote saying, and I think it's sort of really well known, you know, she sent this out to multiple publishers and it got turned down by absolutely everybody.
That's so interesting.
It was very soon after 9/11 and everybody came back going, Americans' tolerance for violence is no longer what it was. Ha ha, look at us now, this deep in violence again. But there is no market for this. And this tiny, tiny little publishing house who published her once before, called Serpent Tale, I think, they agreed to do it.
The most amazing story.
But that she did it. And what was so fun hearing about that was that not only was it just this little publishing house, but then it was these Upper East Side ladies who were bicycling and running the book over to one another. It started entirely with word of mouth. It started entirely with word of mouth, and it took on from there, from people like you, unable to contain themselves at dinner parties, going, you've got to read this. Because I went back and looked, and I tend to just go to The Guardian for this stuff, but the original review of it in The Guardian on when it was published in 2003 is an absolutely lukewarm review.
Yeah,
I bet. Absolutely.
I don't know how you can have a lukewarm reaction to that book.
I felt the same way. I felt like either come down heavy, like if you stylistically, if it's not your bag, I get it. But you have to admire the balls of a woman to write like this.
And also,
I love that she's got a man's name. Not that that's her choice.
I know.
Something very revealing about
it. Yeah, I know. I know. I feel the same. Because I waxed lyrical about it on Twitter when I'd read it. And I remember a few people being like, no, it didn't do it for me. And I'm like, I just wanted to say, I don't think you tried. I don't know.
Go back and try again.
I think you can get to the end of that book and go, oh, that was a schlep.
Right.
Or that was, that I found that letter style quite hard. If you don't engage with it, then I can see how you can do it. But just the very basic story points of what that kid is and does, you don't know how you can't go on a journey with it.
I agree.
So anyway, but I think it really divided people. Another funny thing about Lana Shriver is when I was writing The Cows, I said I just had art and I was really struggling with trying to get my head back into work. And because there's one of the characters in The Cows chooses not to have children. So I was just reading about, you know, women publicly have talked about not having kids. And there's one book, and it's called something like 10 Writers Talk About Why You Can't Have Kids and Be a Writer. And Lionel contributed in it. And she was just quite blatant. You just cannot be a writer and have kids. And I like to set the record straight that now I feel like you can. But at that point in between kids, I was like, you're right, you fucking can't. This is just, I've ruined it. I don't know what I'm doing.
It's one or the other.
Or something, because I can't write anymore.
She's
I love how just thoroughly Lionel Shriver she is about being Lionel Shriver, and that book's great, and I loved her other books as well.
I haven't read her other ones. Talk to me about which one next, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit or Legendary Authors.
So Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit is I read it when I was at school, and it's,
how old are you?
Probably about 16. No, it would have been A levels, so maybe around 17. I really couldn't stand all of the school texts that I was ever given. Side with Rosie can fuck off. I can remember just being like, are you trying to make me fail? Are you trying to stop me reading? I didn't understand it. And
that's great.
But Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit just kind of appeared on the reading list.
As a set text. Wow.
I think it was. It must have been because I got it as a, like, I've marked it up. My copy is marked up.
Right.
I don't really remember much about school, but I remember reading this book. And I was definitely involved. We definitely studied it. And I was like, wow, this is unlikely. I'd lost my mum. I loved reading books and still love reading books and write books about complicated relationships with mothers. That was just... I think when I was a teenager, any book that made me feel like there was another girl who didn't have that I'm in trouble, I'll call my mum type lifestyle was just really comforting for me.
Yeah.
And so that was what... That was initially, I guess, why I loved it. Then I loved the fact that she was a lesbian. Mm. I was reading it in Guernsey, which I told you was very, you know, we had the occasional gay person, but... It was a really, what's even the right word to use?
Sheltered
place. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Mm.
And I don't think anyone was deliberately...
No, but if you grew up on a tiny island, that's not something that's just a function of
exactly.
Doing
I don't feel like it was a racist place or I can't think of any of my words. Just a what's the word when you're
homophobic?
Homophobic, but just the word that kind of encapsulates all of those things. Prejudice,
right.
Or whatever. That's not the word, but that will do. I don't think the people I know are like that, but I just think it was the facts were that it was white and wealthy, and there weren't many gay people. And the few people that I know who came out as gay, I want to go back and just say, fucking well done.
Because so brave.
I don't think at the time I realised how brave it was.
Sure.
So there was this book that we were reading, and that was just so exciting to see this young girl go through this experience. I think it was my first time of going, oh, that's an actual thing that you have got to, that you realise in yourself. And you have to tell the people around you and then be judged or abandoned or you hide it. And then you're not. And I was like, God, that made me, opened up my heart and opened up my mind to what people actually experience in life and about being true to who you are. And all of those messages is what I got from the book. So it was my first real book, I think, that took me out of the Guernsey bubble.
Interesting.
And made me empathize with people a lot more and made me want to be exactly who I wanted to be as well.
Wow.
So it was a really important book.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of my, sorry, that was my chair.
Yeah, it's fine.
Um, I'm proud of whatever teacher or curriculum gave me that book to read at that
age. I'm so impressed too. I didn't come to Jeanette Winterson until way late. I think I read Oranges, but maybe in my early 20s. And then I read her later stuff here in LA. I was given it by a very book-loving guy that I adored, who gave me Gut Symmetries and Written on the Body.
Oh, yeah. Read those? Yeah, I read Gut Symmetry.
Oh, my God. I loved them. I loved them. I think she... It's not erotic, but it's there's a, you can tell just from the titles, there's an immersion in the body that she inhabits that is so sensorial, not even sensual, but just there's a sensuality to the way that she writes. That's not so much there in Oranges, because that's more.
But I found Oranges so sexual.
Did
though.
You?
Yeah. And weirdly, it's not explicit in any way, but I definitely had a good wank in the bath at various points about being lesbian.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it just does, like, it definitely excited me as a teenage girl and made me kind of
wonder,
think about
that.
Where I was at with all that, which was all over the place for a while.
Right.
So I love the way she writes. And then, you know, her memoir was basically Oranges Not the Only Fruit, the kind of the real version.
No.
I'd love to meet her, actually. I imagine... I actually had an email thing with her not very long ago, because when I had my company, I did a skirt and I printed some quotes from Oranges onto the skirt. So she said that I could use the quotes for a year if I gave her two skirts, which was great and amazing. But I never got to meet her. I totally imagine meeting her and being like, oh, you're a bit scary.
Right. Yes, I would think.
Yeah, maybe she wouldn't be, but I imagine that she'd be an author that I'd meet. And even though I'm such a massive fan, I'm sure I'd still be a bit like, ooh.
Will you send me a picture of the skirts?
Yes, I will.
I'll post them when we're
out.
Really,
So I think, I don't know, I find her fascinating as a writer, as a person, and I love the fact that Oranges is, you know, there's some, it's very real to her own experience. Mm. You feel like you're just writing it. She's written a, you know, a flowery version of her real existence.
Yeah.
But I loved it.
Yeah.
For so many reasons.
No, it's true. It's interesting because, you know, I noticed this about your books. So Jane Eyre, the subtitle was it, or maybe originally it was called Jane Eyre ; An Autobiography.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's written, as we know, from Jane's point of view.
Yeah.
And then we need to talk about Kevin is also a first person narrator, albeit, you know, through letters. And then Oranges is not a memoir and yet basically a memoir. I'm really struck that all of these books...
And all of the books I've ever written have all been in first person.
Yes.
Because, I'm thinking about the next, not the one I'm writing now, but the next one. I'm toying with doing a third person book, because I like the fact that you can go beyond the room.
Sure.
And I find that really exciting, but that the way that you can get into a character's head when you're in their head is a difficult thing to leave behind, because, but I am excited about the idea of being able to leave the room.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but all my favourite books are written in first person.
That's interesting.
Especially ones with, like, really great female characters.
Yeah.
You can just kind of get into their shoes.
Yeah. Let's talk about your last one.
Yes.
Legendary Authors and the Clothes They Wore, Terry Newman, 2017. So you, first of all, carry the accolade of having picked the most recent formative book that anyone's ever done. When I looked this up, I was riveted. I'm praying you've got a copy of this that I can take a look at
as
we leave.
And I haven't read the whole thing. Someone gave it, it was only my birthday a few weeks ago, and my friend Nancy gave it to me as my birthday
present.
Oh,
really?
Because I, too, have a podcast called Get It On, which is about the importance of what we wear.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I'm approaching guests to be on my podcast, of which you will be.
I can't wait.
I'm just not as organised as you, so sometimes I'm approaching people, like, I have, for example, I'm going to name and shame him because it's actually Nancy's husband, Louis Theroux.
Yes.
He really wants to be a guest on the podcast, and I can tell when I asked him, he's a bit like, oh, but clothes.
Yeah.
Like, but it's not about clothes.
Of course it's not.
The way, if you dress in a jade pair of chino shorts with a matching jade t-shirt that you got in a catalogue for $14.99 because you don't care. That says as much about you.
Of course it does, as if you wear a vintage.
Exactly.
Thing from
I think with the podcast, all I want people to understand is those people that say they don't care about their clothes are making as much of a statement as someone that says they do. And so this book that Nancy gave me, I'm giving you this as my one of my five most influential books is simply based on the title and the premise of the book, rather than the fact that I've read it.
I was intrigued by it.
Because I was like, fuck, that book is everything. And so now when I'm approaching people to interview on my podcast, if they give me that, I'm not interested. I'm like, this book about famous authors and what they wear is fascinating. And they suddenly go, I'm fascinated because
totally,
I'm what I wear.
Of course I am.
And you're like, it's great to have it in print to know that what I think is true is
sanctified by it. Yes, that someone's dedicated a book about.
And the fact that it's so interesting what writers wear.
Yeah.
And
well, also they pick from what I saw, and you'll show me on the way out, but they pick really interesting men and women of letters. So and all of them have a distinctive look. I mean, the cover alone of Joan Didion sort of slouching on a car, and then
so cool.
Who were the others that I love? Truman Capote is an obvious one. Carl Ove Nausgaard, who I love.
I haven't got to him yet.
Oh my god! Well, I'm obsessed with him. I think he's the sexiest man alive, and I just love all his books. And I have they're this thick, and they're so daunting, but they are. He's just he'll make a walk through the park somehow tense, sexy, fraught with dangers, and he's literally crossed the park and had an existential crisis while pushing his kid in a stroller. It's fucking ridiculous, but it's so compelling. And every photo, because you know they're all autobiography, these huge books, and every photo is him looking sort of increasingly more craggy and seemingly utterly careless, with maybe a cigarette sticking out of his mouth. And everyone makes him more and more attractive to me. He's my secret boyfriend.
But it's so true. So Neil Gaiman's a friend of mine, and I interviewed Amanda, his wife, for my last series, and I'd asked Neil, and I could tell he was slightly like, I don't really get it.
Right.
And so I sent him the picture of the book the other day and said, Neil, this is why you have to be a guest on my podcast.
Brilliant.
And he totally got it into doing it. Because what I love about Neil is that he's an incredibly successful writer, and he's just this wonderful eccentric. And I feel like if someone was to say to me, draw your romantic version of what a male writer looks like, I would draw Neil Gaiman.
Oh, really?
And he probably hasn't done that on purpose, but his kind of shaggy blazer and his moppy hair, and the fact that he always just looks a bit like he's on a deadline. And it speaks so much about who he is, and he looks really disorganized, and he probably is.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so interesting. I love that book so much.
Lovely.
Not only because it absolutely solidified the reason why I should make that podcast.
Sure.
Secondly, because it's man my route to getting good guests. And thirdly, because it's just really interesting.
Yeah.
And as a writer, what I wear really matters. It definitely affects my day. Like when I go and write in a cafe, you know, they always say, they know me in this, they're great outfit today. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, it is.
Yeah.
It is a great outfit. Right. Because I decided what I was going to wear today because I'm in the mood to wear my badass jumpsuit.
Right.
Or I'm feeling a bit wistful. I'm going to write a scene that's quite emotional, and so I'm wearing some floaty dress.
Right.
And I really use it.
Right.
Like at home today, I'm wearing my mum Gris because I'm having a day at home and you're coming over. And, you know, every 5 minutes I'll run into...
By the way, still rocking them like the sexy goddess you are.
I have an off-the-shoulder thing.
I'm loving the off-the-shoulder. It's all working.
Thank you so much.
What
you can't see is the new bra that I bought that is, and my boobs are bulging out the side because I've just stopped breastfeeding and I have no idea what size my tits are.
No, you just got to give it a month.
That
you
was
really
a completely unnecessary...
No, not at all.
...very personal amount of information that I gave you for a podcast about books.
No, that was entirely appropriate given what we're talking about.
Yes.
And I'm also fascinated because the idea that there is a correlation between what you wear and how you write, I think is intrinsic to who you are. You've already told me that your ideal room has got vintage dresses and a desk in it. So it's fun to thread the needle of like, well, where do those meet?
Yeah.
I know that I, when I write, used to just throw on sweatpants and or go from
those
the gym.
Those are not the good days.
They're not the good days. Mm-hmm. And also there's something about, and this is too sort of emerging from the fog of motherhood, was going, no, I will reclaim my body, hence, and a sort of room of one's own. Mm-hmm. And I will reclaim my sense of identity, and so much of who that identity is what I read and how I dress and how I present in that way. I also write sometimes at the Malibu Soho House, and so you really have to pull
really
it together
have to step
there.
It up.
Dude, you have to because the waitresses alone are just sort of heart-numbingly gorgeous.
See,
so
my little cafe that I write in here in West Hollywood is just full of like guys who have just worked out. So it's like me in some kind of floaty chiffon number, and then just these meatheads
setting hearts aflame down on Melrose.
And then Chris will come in on his way back from the gym and like eat half my burrito, and I'm just darling, and they all just think it's really on my typewriter that I now use to write on. on, which is really loud and clunky, so like I'm pretending to be some Bronte sister. But
I love it.
I think when you're writing, it's really nice to set your own little scene and being presentable. Not necessarily feeling like you look good, but just that you're interested in how you're feeling and present in yourself. It definitely, definitely helps. When I roll out of bed and don't get dressed all day, those are the days where I feel like I could never write another word again.
Right. So true.
Yeah.
It's so true. And it is about being present to yourself. It's such a good observation, I think, that you, that having paid attention to what you wear means that you have not just curated it, but also... Look, is there a baby coming to see you?
Do you want this on your podcast?
Yes, I do. I think there's a baby about to come in. This is the first baby of the podcast.
Hi.
Is there a Valentine? Please don't bring him in. There's a Valentine.
You won't make any noise.
Hello, darling.
This is Valentine on a podcast.
Oh, my Lord. And this is me going to party on my podcast.
Are you
going to
say anything, Val?
Hello, darling.
What do you think?
Oh, look at those eyes. Oh, my God. I'm looking at one of the most delicious babies you've ever, ever seen right now.
He's pretty yummy. He's not going to say anything.
Hello, darling. Then. Well, you're going to want to hit the microphone. I'm going to ask you one question then, because we've done so many. Val's left us, which is heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking.
I just lost my Valentine. I have one last question for you. You can take one book to your desert island. What is it? It can be one of the five, or it can be another one altogether.
Oh, my goodness
I
me.
I know. You didn't
That's
see that coming.
Really hard.
I know.
One book, the Bible, obviously, just joking. I wouldn't. No, that was disrespectful. I
Somebody will, at some point.
Of course. What would I take to a desert island? Oh my goodness. I'd take a notebook.
Would you? An empty notebook? I'll let you take a pencil as well.
If I could take a pencil, is that a boring answer?
No, it's wonderful. Nobody's ever said that.
I think it would be really frustrating, but I think the least that I can do is leave behind a notebook with a story in it.
Lovely. Great. Dawn, thank you so much.
This has been
such a pleasure. Thank you for being my guest.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website bookishwithsonyawalger.com if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from, or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.